In today's segment of our review of Menachem Begin's life, and particularly the Jewish dimension of his life, the Jewish soul that made him the person who he was and helped him to shape the state of Israel in the way that he did, we're going to actually look a little bit more in detail at the years in which he was in the opposition, and towards the end of today we'll get to his actual election to the Knesset. One of the reasons that it's interesting to look at the opposition years is because, as we mentioned in that story that we told last time about Benny Begin kind of chastising me personally for being a little bit hard on Ben Gurion in those reparation discussions, and Benny Begin said to me, you know, my father really didn't have to feed anybody. My father wasn't responsible for putting a roof over people's heads. He was pointing to the true fact, which is, of course, that when you're in the opposition, you have a certain leeway, both about what you do, but also about what you say, that you don't necessarily have when you are running the government. When Begin comes into power, he will do things that we're all familiar with. There will, of course, be the famous peace treaty with Egypt, and we'll get to the Nobel Prize, and then, of course, we'll get to the attack on the nuclear reactor in Iraq, and then we'll get to the beginning of the Lebanon War. Those are all very well known, and we'll, of course, cover them. But some of the things that happen in the period of his being in the opposition are much less well known, and I think that they're interesting particularly because of that, because he's given a kind of a leeway to speak his mind that he can't necessarily do when he becomes prime minister. And again, just to remind us all the particular vantage point that we're taking when we think about Begin, we're looking at this Jewish soul that animates the man. And we spoke in our first section about the first 29 years of his life, growing up in a very devoted Bible-centered house and Zionism at the core, his rise in Beitar, meeting Jabotinsky, feeling that his life was all of a sudden sanctified to something that he would devote the rest of his years to. We talked about the Beitar anthem and Hadar, the importance of revolt. And then we get him, of course, to Palestine in the second section, which brings him to Palestine sometime in the spring of 1942. And we cover all of the years, the very complicated, profound years of his time in the revolt to get the British out. And then beginning with Israel's independence, we talked about the Altalena and the reparations, which were two events right after Israel's founding that shaped not only the country, but shaped him and shaped his reputation in Israel. Now, the question is, what happens between the Altalena right after independence and then the reparations a little bit later, and all those years that are going to pass until he is elected into office in 1977? There are a number of incidences there that I believe are really important and actually fascinating that most people don't really talk about a lot, and that's what we're going to begin to look at today. We'll look at the issue of Israel's military rule over Israeli Arabs in the first years of the country and what Begin's attitude to that was. Say a brief bit about his attitude to the formation of Israel's constitution, which of course didn't happen, but he had attitudes to it. We're going to talk about the Soblin affair, the Robert Soblin affair that many people are completely unfamiliar with. Then we'll get briefly to the Six-Day War. We'll say something about what he did post-73, and then of course the election and what's called the Mahapach, the overturning, which we'll come to. But we'll talk a little bit first about Israel's military rule over Israeli Arabs. Now, that may sound strange because today, so many years later, not many people even remember that there was such a thing. But let's bring ourselves back to the end of the War of Independence and remember that who is an Israeli Arab and who is an Arab refugee over the border, whether it's in Jordan, whether it's in Syria or Lebanon. Whichever one you were, as we've said, is really an accident of history. If you wanted to flee and you were quote-unquote successful, well, then now you're a refugee. But if you wanted to flee and you failed to be able to flee, your car didn't start, the roads were blocked, whatever the case was, now you were trapped, but of course you're an Israeli citizen, which will ultimately be a much better fate for you. From the point of view of the Jewish majority, though, towards the end of the war and right after the war, we have to recall that people understood that a significant portion of the Arabs who remained in Israel because they couldn't get away. Their remaining in Israel was by no means a statement of identification with the Jewish state. It by no means meant that they had somehow sided with the Jews in the war. That was hardly the case. And the question really became, what do we do with these people? I mean, they could have been on the other side very easily. Had the war continued, they might have fled, but now they're inside and now our citizens. What do we do? Beginning on October 1st, 1948, the war's not even entirely over yet, but Israel is, of course, a sovereign state. The decision is made to put Israeli Arabs under what's called a mimshal tzva'i, not a mishtar tzva'i, which it is often mistakenly called. It's not a military authority in a kind of an overbearing sense, but it is a mimshal. It's an authority in a much lighter sense, and a government for the Arabs within the state of Israel. Sounds a little crazy. It was not terribly controversial when it first started, but it does become controversial as time goes on. Begin doesn't say anything about it at the very beginning. It seems to everyone involved that it's actually necessary. And what this military authority did was that it was essentially a buffer through the military between Arab citizens of Israel and the regular domestic government for regular citizens. But at a certain point, Arabs had to get permission to move from one village to another inside Israel. If they ended up in the judicial system for whatever reason, they ended up in a judicial system that was basically modulated by the military establishment and not so much the civilian establishment. So it was a complicated situation, and as time goes on and as the war recedes, and as it's clear that Israeli Arabs are not a fifth column, they are citizens with whatever feelings they have, but they're by no means a fifth column, people are beginning to talk more and more whether a democracy worth its name can really have a kind of a military authority over citizens and have that military authority apply to one particular ethnic and religious group. Begin is saying very early on, don't forget he's a lawyer, he is a liberal in the Jabotinsky sense of liberal. He's a liberal in the authentic sense of individual rights and fairness and equality. It just doesn't seem right to him. Things begin to get much more complicated in another incident in which he's really not involved, but it's worth mentioning just a bit to give a sense of those times. The 1956 war, the Suez War, Mivtza Kadesh, the Sinai campaign, called many different things, breaks out in October 1956. The very day that the war breaks out, Israel's Arabs, who are again under this military authority, are put under a curfew, a very strict curfew, which was around the end of the afternoon, the early part of the evening. You have to remember, of course, that communications back then were very, very different. And in really what is a tragic and horrific event in Israeli history, in an Arab town called Kafr Qasim, if you're driving up the 6 highway north these days, you will find an exit that says Qasim. That's Kafr Qasim. It's still there. It's still a big Arab village. It was then really on the Green Line, which was essentially the border with Jordan, of course. A Magav group, a border patrol of Israeli soldiers, are out patrolling. Tensions are high because of the beginning of the war. And there is a group of Arabs who were coming back from working the fields who, and nobody can test the following, had literally not heard that there was a curfew. And a command was given, and the Magav opened fire, killing 48 people. They killed men, they killed 6 women, they killed 23 children. It was an atrocity. And there's almost no historian of Israel who will call it anything but what it was. Ben-Gurion, because Ben-Gurion knew how to handle these kinds of things, imposed a complete news blackout on it and cordoned off the area militarily. And eventually it came to court, and certain people were convicted, though the punishments were relatively minor. But after the Kafr Qasim incident happens, and once the war in Sinai subsides and people can restore their attention to that, there's an awareness that something in the Israeli-Arab situation really has to give and has to change. And it's at this point that Begin begins to write columns, and he speaks openly in Knesset committee meetings, and he says this has to change. A democracy worth its name cannot have one authority for Jewish citizens and one authority for Muslim citizens. You just can't do it. Now, at the end of the day, he actually becomes one of the people who really pushes very forcefully for it to end, which it'll do in the 1960s. But his role in this begins to make some people on the left think, wow, there is a different side to the Menachem Begin that we haven't really thought about. A different side from the hanging of the sergeants, a different side from the King David bombing, a different side from the Altalena. He begins to strike people as being more complex and more sophisticated and more nuanced, and in the very best of senses, a bit more unpredictable than many people had thought. Now, it is true, by the way, and it needs to be said in order to be fair and honest, that when he spoke about the Kafr Qasim incident specifically, Begin did not assail the soldiers, and he was very hesitant to critique the army, because remember, as far as he was concerned, This was an army that was the continuation of a biblical narrative. So on one hand, he knew that this was wrong. He called it a horrific tragedy. He didn't say anything about it that would in any way whitewash it. But he didn't lambast the soldiers or the officers the way some people on the left did, perhaps because he was really constitutionally unable to, because these were the warriors, as far as he was concerned, who were the inheritors of Yoab and Tsruiah. They were the people who were the inheritors of David, King David's generals, and so on and so forth. But he knew it was wrong, he said it was wrong, and he becomes one of the prominent voices for ending the military authority over Arabs, which happens in the 1960s. There's another piece, very small, which we'll mention only very briefly, which also begins to indicate to people that what you have here really is an authentic liberal, again, not in the right-left sense, but in the most meaningful sense of that word. And that has to do with Israel's writing a constitution. The Declaration of Independence, as many people know, said that by the 1st of October 1948, there would be a constitution that would be ratified. Obviously, in 2020, now we don't have a constitution yet. That never happened. Ben-Gurion had every reason not to want to pass a constitution. He did not like the makeup of the government the way that it was. Mapai, Mapam, the parties on the left did not have the absolute control that he wished that they had had, and therefore he understood that any constitution that would be written at that point would not reflect the kind of Jewish state that he personally wanted. And therefore he kind of brazenly just put off the writing of the constitution. Begin was also not terribly eager to have the Constitution passed at that time because the power balance in the Knesset wasn't what he wanted it to be either, but he did understand and said vocally on several occasions that it was wrong for Israel not to move forward with the writing of a Constitution. And even back then, in the late 50s, early 60s, Haaretz gives him a very rare compliment, and it says, "It is strange to see how a political movement that is by its very nature tends to strengthen the executive force." That's a very nice way of saying that you would hardly think that Menachem Begin, of all people, would be committed to liberal principles, is asking here to represent pure liberalism. They didn't accuse Begin of anything other than being what he was actually doing, which was actually representing pure liberalism. And we'll see his pure liberalism, his focus on individual rights, his focus on the integrity of the judicial system, come to bear certainly when he is prime minister and the Supreme Court rules against him in one particular case, which we'll talk about next time, in which case it's very clear that he says, "I don't agree, but there are judges in Jerusalem." But we see it even in the early 1960s in the Robert Soblin affair, which today, almost 60 years later, almost nobody's heard of anymore, which is actually kind of surprising and unfortunate. Robert Soblin was an American Jew. He had been born in Lithuania and had become naturalized as an American citizen in 1947, and he practiced psychiatry in New York. In July 1961, which is about 14 years after he gets to America, he is convicted by the American courts of espionage on the part of the Soviet Union. This is not one of those Julius and Ethel Rosenberg cases where one can debate, were they guilty, were they not guilty? Everybody knew that Robert Soblin was guilty. There was nobody really outside of him who claimed otherwise. But he was a pretty wily character who also had cancer at that point. And though he was sentenced to a very long sentence, he asked for a reprieve of a few days so he could get his affairs in order before he went to jail for what might very well be the rest of his life. And he uses a forged Canadian passport during those few days, so the Americans were not at the top of their game, to put it very mildly, to flee the United States, and he goes to Israel, and he enters Israel under the law of return. Now, we're familiar that there's actually a very famous case in Israel unfolding right now with an Australian citizen who's come to Israel under the law of return, evading the Australian judicial system. And there have been many people who have done this over the years, the most notorious of whom was Meir Lansky. He was a good old-fashioned gangster from Miami, but Israel extradited him. But this is what happens much earlier than Lansky, who comes in around 1970. This happens already in 62. And Robert Soblin comes to Israel and says, "I'm here under the law of return." And Israel had no extradition treaty with the United States. So he had every reason to actually believe that he had actually outwitted the authorities. Israel did not have to extradite him. He was Jewish. He could come to Israel on the law of return. He thought that he might have actually found permanent sanctuary. But if you think about it, of course, David Ben-Gurion was not in any mood to get into a row with John F. Kennedy over a person who was a spy for the Soviet Union. There was just nothing in it for David Ben-Gurion, and he makes it very clear, both internally and externally right away, extradition treaty or not, he's going to get rid of Robert Soblin. But Menachem Begin, among others, say that may very well be all well and fair, but the guy has a right to due process. It's true that he came into Israel illegally in a sense that he used a forged passport, but we should somehow have a serious judicial process. So Israel announces to the world, to the Americans, trying to get them to calm down, trying to get the opposition to calm down, that they're going to hold Soblin for 10 days, during which time they are going to review very carefully how he got into the country, what the legal status is, and so on and so forth. But Ben-Gurion actually does nothing of the sort. He has Soblin taken out of his cell 2 days later, handed over to an American marshal, which is basically turning him over to the Americans despite the absence of an extradition treaty. The marshal takes him on a flight to the United States, which stops in Athens and then stops in London and was supposed to go on to New York. As the plane is landing in London, Soblin stabs himself in the stomach and in other places, and he has to be taken off the plane to a British hospital where he recuperates. We're going to telescope the legal part of the story very quickly. He actually applies to stay in Israel. He's not granted permission. There's a lot of haggling between Israel and the United States. At the end of a very complicated process, everybody agrees he's going to fly from London to the United States and serve his prison sentence. Somehow or another, he gets his hands on an overdose of barbiturates, basically commits suicide in the London hospital, and that's the end of the story. But what's interesting for us, of course, is not what happened to Robert Soblin, but what Menachem Begin said about this when this was unfolding as a very passionate debate in the Knesset. And he's here speaking to Moshe Shapiro, who is the Minister of the Interior. And he says the following, and listen to the difference in tone from this to what he had said just about 10 years earlier in reparations. Remember the tone that he used to people that he disagreed with. Remember that he'd been distanced from the Knesset, suspended from the Knesset for 3 months, how he'd been publicly chastised. Now listen to Menachem Begin in the early 1960s. He says, "You know, Mr. Shapiro, that I view you with both respect and affection, but I beg you to understand, if Reuven deceives Shimon and uses his signature, and in so doing acquires a certain amount of money, should Reuven appear before the court to justify his actions, he cannot, for the sake of his acquittal, say, 'But I succeeded.'" In other words, his argument can't be, "Well, it worked." Ben-Gurion can't just say, "Well, it worked. I got out of my little problem with John F. Kennedy. Soblin is gone. It's not a problem." And notice, of course, the Reuven and Shimon analogy. Anyone who's spent time in yeshiva knows that that's yeshiva language for any kind of dispute over money or land, property, whatever it might be. If you're studying Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Batra, those are the kinds of names that always get used, yeshiva language, for two litigants. And then he says to the government, not specifically to Moshe Shapiro, also again continuing his tilting of his hand in the direction of the traditional Jewish world, first Reuven and Shimon, and now this. He says, "A government that respects justice and law should have been willing to take its case," he said, "with heads held high, a pure heart, and clean hands." Now, it could have been just nice Hebrew. What he said was, "Nechi kapayim uvar levav." But everybody in the Knesset then, practically, certainly almost all of the Jewish members of the Knesset, understood that that was actually, of course, from a psalm. And it was a quote from the Psalms, which we actually recite sometimes as the Torah is brought around inside the synagogue. So a lot of Jews, even if they no longer went to the synagogue, if they had gone as youth, they knew this phrase, "Niki chapayim uvar levav, asher lo nasar lashav nafshi v'lo nishba l'mirma." He who stands clean with a pure heart, who has not taken a false oath by my life, or sworn deceitfully. And Menachem Begin is saying basically here that the debates in the Knesset in 1962 have to be on a certain level biblical debates. The Bible has a sense of purity of soul. The Bible has a sense of cleanliness of hands. And what we need to do when we have debates in the Knesset even if it's thousands of years later, is to have that sacred book in mind and actually to quote it unabashedly in a passionate speech in the middle of the Knesset. And then he says, not quoting Bible, not quoting Talmud, he just says to Ben-Gurion, of what were we embarrassed? Of whom were we afraid? What were you so afraid about, keeping Soblin in jail for 10 days to let the judicial process unfold the way that it should have? And in saying to Ben-Gurion, of what were we embarrassed? Of whom were we afraid? What Begin is doing here is really saying to Ben-Gurion, who are you calling a diaspora Jew? Who's the Jew who's really afraid, so to speak, of the goyim outside there? Who's the one who's nervous? Who's the one who's unable to stand for his own independent country and so forth? And he very cleverly, without saying it, because he's learned his lesson from approximately 10 years earlier, he understands that what he had done back then won't work. He's very, very critical of Ben-Gurion. He actually gives a long speech, which we won't quote right now, in which he reminds Ben-Gurion, we both started law school, but one of us finished law school and one of us didn't, because Begin was a lawyer and Ben-Gurion never finished law school. There's also a personal dig at Ben-Gurion, which neither Ben-Gurion nor Begin could ever kind of resist towards the other. But he emerges from this as the spokesperson for judicial rights, the spokesperson for a serious judiciary, and the spokesperson for a liberalism that is deeply rooted in Jewish tradition, with that nod towards the yeshiva language, that nod towards the Book of Psalms, and so on and so forth. Now, 5 years after the Soblin affair, and obviously totally unrelated, is going to come the Six-Day War. And we're not going to spend time now going into the details of the war. It's a whole other story, and Begin is not the prime minister, so he's really only partially involved. But I'm sure everyone knows that Levi Eshkol is the prime minister at the beginning of the Six-Day War. And at the beginning of the war, he gives what's called the stammering speech. He gives a speech in which he stammers, reading it out to the public, trying to reassure them in some way. And the speech actually upsets people more than it reassures them by a factor of many. It wasn't entirely his fault, by the way. He had typed up a speech, and at the last minute, it had been edited by him and others, and there was writing all over the typewritten page. Then there wasn't enough time to type it before he had to go on air, so he's reading from something that's all written all over, and he just can't read the handwriting. But it's a very, very, very horrible day in Israeli life before the war. And relatively quickly thereafter, there's a decision to create a unity government. Unity government means that there's no coalition and opposition. All the parties, or most of the parties, get together and agree to set differences aside for the duration of whatever crisis they're facing. And Begin, as the head of the opposition, is now brought into the unity government, and for the first time in his life, is actually a member of the cabinet in 1967. And two things happen in his role as part of the cabinet in the war that really just need to be mentioned briefly to give us a sense of the soul of this man. To say that Levi Eshkol was not inspiring confidence in the Israeli people is an extraordinary understatement. Now, to his credit, by the way, and to be fair, he was following essentially David Ben-Gurion, which was no small feat. But Levi Eshkol, as decent as a human being as he might have been, was not a great person of character, charisma, and so forth. He wasn't going to inspire this kind of confidence. And of course, Israelis are deeply worried. People probably know that before the war started, the rabbinate consecrated the Ramat Gan Stadium as a place where up to 40,000 people could be buried. People were expecting the worst possible atrocities because Nasser has said we're going to push the Jews into the sea. And what Begin says when he gets to the cabinet is this. He says, he does it nicely so that Eshkol is not offended, but he says, what if we bring Ben-Gurion back out of retirement and ask him to take the reins for however long this war, which was inevitable, is going to last? He's not the one who goes and asks Ben-Gurion, but actually the message is brought to Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion does not want to come back, certainly doesn't want to come back under those circumstances. And he says no, but he is told that it was Begin who had come up with this idea. And Ben-Gurion says not that long thereafter, he said, if I had known him then, meaning in previous years, the way that I know him now, history might have played out very differently. And when I think about that Ben-Gurion quote, I actually find it kind of heartbreaking. Because as divisive and as acrimonious and as potentially lethal as their relationship was, They shared so much in common. Their devotion and their passions and their Zionism and their commitment to the Jewish people were so overlapping that they should have had a kind of a friendship, even if they disagreed. You could imagine Rava and Shmuel or Abaye and Rava from the Talmudic period. You can disagree about a lot of halachic things back then, but your relationship can be at least cordial, if not beyond that. But it doesn't happen in time. At the end of his life, and I was told about this actually after my biography of Begin had already come out, unfortunately, so I wasn't able to include it. But somebody who read the biography came up to me and told me that she had actually witnessed the following, that Ben-Gurion was already aging and was completely out of the political world. Ben-Gurion and Begin was still in. And at a certain point, David Ben-Gurion came into the cafeteria of the Knesset, just looking to get lunch. And he came up to a table where, among other people, Begin was sitting, and there was no empty space at the table. You can sort of imagine a high school situation like that. And Ben-Gurion's kind of looking around, where am I going to go sit? And it was Begin himself who leapt up, said, take a seat, and he goes over to a different table and brings over a chair for himself. In other words, the relationship does warm in a very kind of a meaningful way towards the end, and one only wishes that it had happened earlier, because a partnership of a different sort could have been a very, very different kind of a thing. The second thing that happens in the discussion of the war, and this is now after the war had started, and we have to remember that Israel completely destroys Egypt's air force in the first 3 hours of the war. The pilots essentially take off in large numbers at 7:30 in the morning, and by 10:35, Rabin, who's the chief of staff, has gotten a brief message: the Egyptian air force no longer exists. They destroyed 23 bases, they'd killed a third of all of Egypt's pilots. I mean, it was a hugely successful raid, very brave and daring, by the way, in the sense that they left 12 planes back to defend the rest of the country. It's a whole story which we don't have time for now. But by a few days into the war, it's clear that Israel's going to win. And now the question is, what is Israel going to take? Should it try to take the old city of Jerusalem? Should it try to take what was then called the West Bank? Should it try to take the Golan? All of that had not yet happened at this point in the war. And the minutes of the cabinet meeting quote Begin as saying the following: we're in a war. We're in a war for Israel's survival. And here's what Menachem Begin, who's never been part of the cabinet before, says: if we do enter the old city, and maybe this is simply a ceremonial matter, though in my eyes it is of supreme importance, immediately, if we can physically pull it off from a military point of view, the prime ministers and the members of the government with the two chief rabbis, one Ashkenazi, one Sephardi, of course, should go to the Western Wall and say Shehecheyanu. And they should say Shir HaMa'alot B'Shuv Hashem Et Shivat Zion, when the Lord brought back the exiles to Zion. A quote from Psalm 126, of course. And then he says, and anything else that the rabbis think should be recited then should be recited. Here is this cabinet meeting about what the military can pull off. Can it pull off the capturing of the old city? Can it pull off the capturing of what many people call today Judea and Samaria? Can it actually capture the Golan from the Syrians, who had not been bested yet the way that the Egyptians had, and so forth? And Begin is talking about what ritual should take place at the Western Wall if they should be successful. And of course, that's exactly what happened, essentially. We all know those, we've all seen those videos of the shofar being blown by Rabbi Gorin, the reciting of Shehecheyanu, and so on and so forth. Again, for Begin, there was never a moment in which the Jewish biblical side of this unfolding Israeli story wasn't paramount in his conscience. We'll see this again when we talk about Osi Rak in the next segment, a different time. He makes it very clear, even in the winds of war blowing fiercely, that this is a man who is both Israeli and Jewish in very, very deep ways. Again, in a way not to deny the Jewishness of everyone else, but in a way that is very different from the other major players in Israel's history. Israel, of course, wins the 1967 war. Then there was what's called the conceptia, this false conception, this false sense of security that Israelis have. There is the Bar-Lev line, which many people think is going to be impregnable by the Egyptians, or if not impregnable, then to a very great extent will slow them down. That proved, of course, to be completely false. And the 73 war will happen, the Yom Kippur War unfolds. It is a disaster, as we all know, at least for the first week, and then the army performs admirably. But Israel crawls its way back to the lines from which it started after three very bloody weeks and loses approximately 3,000 soldiers. whereas in 67 it lost approximately 700 soldiers and tripled its size. 6 years later, it loses many times that number of soldiers and has territorially nothing to show for it at all, except that it didn't lose any territory because of the army's handling of things towards the end. The country is really shattered, and I think it's very hard for many of us in 2020, almost 50 years after that war, to still get ourselves into the mindset of how deeply shattered the country was. There was the famous Agranat Commission, which investigated the army and investigated Golda Meir, led to Golda Meir's resignation not that long thereafter. And it cited three generals for having basically failed in their responsibilities. One of them is David Elazar, who was the chief of staff. Elazar dies 3 years later of a heart attack at the age of 51. It's a pretty extraordinary thing. It also castigates Shmuel Gonen, who was the chief of the Southern Command, who leaves to Africa and hardly ever comes back to Israel, who dies of a heart attack at the age of 61. In other words, these men carried on their shoulders and in their minds and in their hearts and their souls a tremendous sense of guilt for what had been clearly a series of gross mistakes about misreading all the intelligence that had come in. And in many respects, Israel is a broken country, and we need to understand that to understand Begin's rise to power in 1977. People talk, and quite rightly, about the role of the Mizrachim, which we'll mention in a minute, in bringing him to power, but we need to understand how broken Israel is after 73 in order to understand why it was almost now, in retrospect, inevitable that Labor would have to eventually be voted out of office. And just to give you one little sense of how long this goes, and I actually, in a different book, in my History of Israel, I argue that Israel, in many respects, still carries the scars of the Yom Kippur War, and in certain ways is still broken. But what Yom Kippur does, the war does, is it convinces Israelis that they're never going to be invulnerable. And if you look, you watch Israeli television before Yom Kippur, most of the television is actually about the war. It's not about the holiday. It's not about tshuva, repentance. It's not about the high holidays. Most of Israeli television right before the Yom Kippur is still, this many years later, really about the war. In 1994, which is many years after the war, obviously 21 years after the war, Shmuel HaSafri publishes a song which is really worth going off and listening to on your own time if you have not heard it. It's called Anachnu HaYeladim Shel Choref 73. We are the children of the winter of 73. It's a haunting melody, and I just want to read you a few lines to give you a sense of the songs that Israelis are singing 20 years later. We are the children of the winter of 1973. You dreamt us first at dawn, at the end of the battles. You were exhausted men who thanked their good fortune. You were worried young women, and you wanted so much to love when you conceived us with love in the winter of 1973. You wanted to fill your bodies with what the war had taken away. When we were born, the country was wounded and sad. You looked at us and you hugged us. You were trying to find comfort. It's a generation of children who say to their parents, you had us almost not because you wanted us, but because you needed us. You were so broken that making a new generation of kids to hug was basically the only thing that you could possibly do. Go online at some time and listen to the performances of this song. They are, you get chills this many years later. So the country is broken. It's important also to remember that in December of 73, Ben-Gurion dies. He does not die because of the war. By the time the war happens, his dementia is tragically pretty far advanced. He had been failing in the later years, but he dies in 73, which to the country is yet another massive blow. The father figure of the country dies just as soon as, almost right after, the country has to come to terms with the inevitability of the enduring nature of its vulnerability. Golda, of course, had failed completely. Then comes Yitzhak Rabin, who is a decent prime minister, but whose wife is caught accidentally, by the way, it's a complicated story we won't go into now, but completely accidentally, his wife is caught in Washington, D.C. By a reporter, and he investigates why she's going into an American bank. And it turns out they have a very small dollar account, leftovers from the days when he had been an ambassador. It was really not corruption in any meaningful kind of a way, but it was against the law. Israelis were not allowed to have accounts outside the country at that time. So as far as Israelis are concerned, the generation of Israel's founders is gone because Ben-Gurion has died. Golda, as far as they were concerned during the war, was a colossal failure. Then comes Yitzhak Rabin. Don't forget the failure of Levi Eshkol to inspire people in 67. Then comes Yitzhak Rabin, and he's got this account. We're barely making ends meet in liras in this country. And you've got dollars in Washington, D.C. It's really kind of a critical mass. It's a perfect storm. And we're going to go to elections very shortly in 1977. But now we do need to talk about the extremely important role of the Mizrahim, those Jews from the Levant, North Africa, Yemen, Iraq, Iran, who were typically darker-skinned Jews. And we've spoken a little bit before about how David Ben-Gurion did not hide in any way his disdain for them and their culture, his desire to have them educated separately from Ashkenazi children. The kibbutzim, by the way, showed their disdain. Think about it. How many Mizrahi member of those old classic kibbutzim can you even think of? Not many at all. The kibbutzim did not want the Mizrahim. The kibbutzim later on did not want all the immigrants that came from the Soviet Union. The kibbutzim liked life in the 30s and the 40s when they were the kind of socialist Zionist elite of the descendants of Europeans, if they weren't Europeans themselves. And the Mizrahim from every different dimension feel that they're pushed aside. David Ben-Gurion used to say openly, there's lots of quotes of him, we have to make sure that they don't bring down the cultural level of Israel by allowing them too much to color our society, our education, and so on and so forth. Virtually no Mizrahim were given any positions of responsibility at all in the Haganah, but that's not true of the Etzel. And Begin spoke with great pride for years afterwards about how the Etzel was totally uninterested in what country you would come from. The Etzel couldn't have cared less what degree or hue your skin color was. They couldn't care about that less. They just wanted to know, were you dedicated to fighting the British and to creating a Jewish state? And as the years go by, and Begin keeps campaigning in each election, and Ben-Gurion keeps campaigning in each election, Ben-Gurion wanted to show off to everyone exactly how Israeli he had become. So he would go to the Ma'abarot, which today are Israel's impoverished cities, but back then were these little shanty towns of Quonset huts that they built because there was no money in the country, especially before reparations. So there were these Quonset hut towns where the Mizrahim were put in when they came in by the hundreds of thousands in the first years of the country. And don't forget, they're tin, they're made of metal. So in the summer, they are unbearably hot. There's obviously no air conditioning. In the winter, everything floods with mud. And those are places that you are probably familiar with. For example, Sderot, still stuck near the Gaza border, not an easy life. That started out as a ma'abara. When you hear about Yerucham, a relatively poor town in the Negev, not all that far from Be'er Sheva, that started out as a ma'abara. Even Talpiot, in Jerusalem, started out as a ma'abara when it was still outside of Jerusalem. And Ben-Gurion and Begin, election after election after election, would keep going to these ma'abarot to campaign. And what Ben-Gurion wanted to show was how deeply Israeli, how thoroughly Israeli he had become. So what did he do? He dressed like an Israeli. And he would go campaign in shorts and little t-shirts. Begin did not do that because he didn't own any shorts and he didn't own any t-shirts. He wore what he owned, which was a suit and a tie. And it didn't matter how blazingly hot it was in the Ma'abarot, Ben-Gurion dressed like he thought a gentleman dresses. Now, the Ashkenazi made fun of him. They said, look how un-Israeli you are. You still think you're in Poland. You're going to Yerucham. You're going to Sderot. It's 95 or 100 degrees outside and you're wearing in a suit and a tie. What's wrong with you? But the Mizrahim didn't have that reaction. They said Ben-Gurion comes and he campaigns, so he's wearing shorts and a t-shirt. And Begin dresses up to come and speak to us. The Ashkenazim just had no read for how the Mizrahim were going to see Begin. And over the course of time, his popularity among the Mizrahim is going to rise and rise. And the Mizrahim are going to make their way more and more and more into Israeli society, beginning a little bit later with the music industry, and they're going to make their way more into education. So now you really have the perfect storm of the country being really entirely tired of, sick of, feeling they'd been abandoned by the Labor Party, and Begin being the person who has been running election after election after election, more and more and more beloved by the Mizrahim. The election in 1977 comes, and Chaim Yavin, who's still alive, but was the newscaster of Israel back in the day, is so stupefied by the results that you can see it on his face when he reads the results, and he makes up a Hebrew word. He calls it a mahapach, which now everybody knows what it means, but back then it was a new kind of a word. It means an upheaval or an overturning. It's one letter short of a revolution, right? Because mahapecha means revolution. Well, it wasn't a revolution. It was a perfectly democratic move. So he calls it a mahapach. But what had happened was that the Likud had gotten 43 seats to Shimon Peres's 32 seats. And for the first time, it is clear, Menachem Begin has won an election. He did not believe that he was going to win. And when I was working on my biography of him and I interviewed some of his American supporters, they also told me they'd been bankrolling him for years and years. And they said, we pretty much understood that as wonderful a human being and as an extraordinary a Jew as Begin was, it was pretty clear he could not win an election. And we decided we'd let him run one more time in 1977. And then we were clearly going to have to make a shift in the leadership of the Likud. And we figured we'd figure that out after the election. Of course, that does not happen. And so Begin is surprised, his supporters are surprised, the country is shocked, and Begin's elected prime minister in 1977. I want to say just a couple of things very quickly about his election, and then we'll pick up what he does as soon as he takes office in our next segment. Very soon after the election results are clear, reporters are kind of shoving microphones in his face everywhere he goes. And someone says something to him about, is there anything you want to say to anyone in particular? And he says, I want to say something to Aliza, his wife, of course. And he says the following words without opening up a Bible, without opening up a piece of paper. He just looks in the camera and says, Zacharti lach chesed nehuraich ahavat tlilotaich lechtech acharai be'eretz zeruat mokshim, which was an intentional misquote. You have to know the Bible pretty well if on the spur of the moment you can actually misquote the Bible exactly when you want to. What was he misquoting? The verse in Jeremiah says, I accounted to your favor the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me into the wilderness. And what did he say in Hebrew? I accounted to your favor the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, as you followed me into a land filled with mines. It was an extraordinary statement of love and devotion. And again, at the most critical, pivotal moments in his life, he actually goes back to the book that his father taught them, the book that they used to quiz their father about at the Shabbat table. He wants to tell his wife in 1977, thank you for sticking with me all this time through imprisonment, when I was imprisoned in Russia, when I'm in hiding and during the revolt, all the things that we've been through. He quotes Jeremiah and knows Jeremiah well enough to misquote him intentionally at exactly that moment. And then at a different moment, not exactly right there, but at around the same time period, another reporter says to him, so what kind of a prime minister are you going to be? In what style are you going to be prime minister? And Begin looks at him stupefied, like, what kind of a question is that? What do you mean? And he thinks for a second and he says, in the style of a good Jew. And that is exactly what he did. And when we pick up next time, we'll see that the very first thing that he does has nothing to do with Israel, has nothing to do with Jews, and has everything to do with caring about human beings wherever they might find themselves. That was liberalism at its best. That was Jabotinsky to a certain extent at his best. And that really was, at the very deepest sense of the word, the style of a good Jew. Yair told me his father would call him up periodically and ask him, you know, what kind of a plane could do this? How far could a plane like this go? How low would a plane have to fly in order to evade radar? His father couldn't say anything about why he was asking these questions. Of course, Yair knew because he was working on the actual plan of attack. So the father and the son are both working on the attack, one of them on the political level, one of them on the military level, and neither could actually tell the other that they knew what was going on.